Several weeks before he left Peking, Meyer visited a small village and noticed, in a house's doorway, a small bush with fruit as yellow as a fresh egg yolk. Meyer ignored a man who told him the plant was ornamental, its fruit not typically eaten but prized for its year-round production. The fruit looked like a mix between a mandarin and a citron, which later genetic testing would confirm. It was a lemon, but smaller and rounder. Its flavor surprised him as both sweeter than a citron and tartar than an orange. And its price, 20 cents per fruit or $10 per tree, suggested that people with an abundance of other citrus valued it greatly. Meyer had little room in his baggage, but he used his double-edged Bowie knife to take a cutting where the branches formed a V, the choice spot to secure its genetic material. That cutting made the voyage to Washington, and then the trip to an experiment station in Chico, California, where it propped up a new lemon industry grateful to receive a sweeter variety. The lemon became known as the Meyer lemon, and from it came lemon tarts, lemon pies, and millions of glasses of lemonade. For this contribution, Meyer wasn't paid much. The government sponsored his travel and his postage. His modest salary, just $1,200 per year, seemed low for a man of such esteem and growing fame. After Meyer's first expedition, Fairchild quietly increased his salary to $1,400. Fairchild also saw to it that Meyer would return to China and its surrounding areas, and then again after that, with each expedition coming the reasonable expectation that Meyer would turn up an incredible new cache of plants. This style of exciting and exhausting plant hunting vaulted Meyer from obscurity to national renown. Fairchild sent a telegram to Gilbert Grosvenor at National Geographic reporting, "Frank Meyer is back from 3 years in northwestern China. He could give an interesting account of agricultural explorations." Fairchild also arranged for Meyer to meet Teddy Roosevelt, a man in the sunset of his presidency but with increasing energy and on a lively streak of environmental conservation. Fairchild thought Roosevelt might be interested in hearing about the deforestation Meyer witnessed in eastern China and the ghastly effects of hillsides cut naked of their trees. Meyer grudgingly accepted the invitation, only because Fairchild insisted. He visited Roosevelt in his Long Island home in Oyster Bay, where the president spent the summer of 1908. Meyer brought photographs of the Wutaishan Mountain east of Beijing, where he had witnessed such devastating deforestation that it triggered landslides that cut off rivers, suffocated farmland, and washed away entire villages. Few men in those days said no to the gregarious Roosevelt, and so when the president asked Meyer if he could include the images in a report to Congress, Meyer, marveling at his trajectory from poor immigrant to a man asked permission by a president, agreed. For all this, he remained humble, often soft-spoken and reluctant to accept credit. But, in rare moments of guarded comfort with Fairchild, Meyer exhibited a healthy sense of self, an ego that had powered him through cold, dark, and thankless months, amid fights with attackers and arguments with translators and rumors of his impending death at the hands of lawless gangs. He kept his confidence hidden, but inside he had grown proud of his growing record as botanical daredevil. "I will be famous," he once said. "Just wait a century or two." Chapter 17. Outlaws, Brigands, and Murderers. Frank Meyer's success wasn't enough to appease Charles Marlett. In fact, it made him even more suspicious. By 1909, Marlett had converted his wariness of Meyer into outright disdain. If not for his childhood friendship with Fairchild, Marlett might have taken Meyer to court, or worse, a dark alley. His anger often verged on spite. When government entomologists discovered a new Chinese insect in America, Marlett, whose government duties also included naming new things, vindictively tagged the pesky bug Dinaspidiotis meyeri. Marlett felt only slightly warmer toward Fairchild. Their wives were friendly. They took weaving classes together, and outwardly, the men were cordial and polite. But in the private conversations they shared with close colleagues, each complained about the other's ineptitude. Marlett's crime was hysteria, and Fairchild's naivete. Marlett's stubbornness was a sign of panic, not reason. It was based on fear and on the idea that the very act of exploring opened oneself to unnecessary risk. Organisms perfectly normal in their natural setting could be dangerous somewhere else, and with no warning. The greatest danger is often from something you do not know about, Marlet warned. It is the unknown things that you cannot find that we have to protect this country from. The best example he offered was the chestnut blight fungus that was strangling American chestnut trees, great icons of the frontier. The blight originated somewhere in China, where it was innocuous, but became dangerous when it entered American borders. This was insane to Fairchild. To be scared of unknown things based on a few cherry-picked examples wasn't a policy. It was an impulse, and a foolish one. For every evil that Marlet illuminated, Fairchild found something good that had come of it. The Chinese chestnut blight that apparently kept Marlet awake at night had also brought Americans new varieties of Oriental pears and Chinese chestnuts, both resistant to the rust, and thus advantageous for America to produce. It would be eminently unfair to assume that because we do not know that little apple seedlings from the Old World or from Japan are as clean and free from disease as any which we can produce in America, they represent undesirable immigrants and should be excluded from the country, Fairchild argued one day to a group of forestry officials, some of whom sympathized with Marlet. Still, Marlet banged his drum louder and more forcefully. The threat of insects was growing more dangerous every day. The boll weevil, which had come to the United States 10 years earlier and tended to feast on cotton flowers and buds, was now beginning its eventual wipeout of the cotton industry, which had just barely regained its footing after the Civil War. Marlet claimed the invasive insect was responsible for the spread of typhus, yellow fever, and malaria. These claims weren't backed up by science, but that hardly mattered. Marlet was simply raising awareness and, in the process, taking little pain to drop frightening words. Dirty. Destroy. Dangerous. If he could have changed government policy himself, he would have. But he and his like-minded colleagues knew that in a representative democracy, lasting change comes not by personal fiat, but from Congress. One of the reasons Marlet was so angry during the cherry blossom episode was because his first attempt to shut down reckless plant imports by legislative vote blew up in his face. He had drafted a bill for Congress that called for inspection of all nursery stock at all American entry points. It wouldn't have ended plant imports, but would have made the process so onerous that Fairchild and his band of explorers would be driven to quit. Marlet found a sympathetic congressman from Kansas to introduce the bill, quietly and during the lethargic lame duck session of 1910. It passed through committee, then through the full House of Representatives, and then through a committee on the Senate side. The penultimate step, before the president signed it into law, would have been passage by the full Senate. But the night before the vote, a group of legislators sympathetic to the nurserymen caught wind of Marlet's idea of national safety. Marlet's proposal, in addition to slowing the activities of Fairchild's office, would have tightened a noose around the entire industry of people who grew plants with imported rootstock. The lawmakers blocked the bill, and Marlet lost. Marlet's boss told him, "Now that you've had your fingers burned, drop the effort." But Marlet refused, vowing that he would immediately engineer a new bill. 4 months after the first defeat, he tried again, this time with another bill, and, rather than attempt in secret, he decided to act in full view of the public. In April of 1910, Marlet testified in front of Congress that the United States needed a Chinese wall of its own to keep out so-called plant enemies. The testimony was almost theater. Marlet dropped scary terms and chilling statistics, to the point that William Pitkin, Fairchild's friend who happened to be head of the American Association of Nurserymen, called his bluffs distortions, or, even worse, pure lies. The rationale that fueled the nurserymen, and Fairchild too, was that America shouldn't act in fear. Most incoming plants from around the world were fine, and responsible inspections of suspicious loads were sufficient. What the nurserymen didn't say, but was certainly true, was that Marlet's quarantine proposal would cost nursery growers billions, plus the incalculable loss of American economic growth. The nurserymen had a powerful voice, but not as powerful as the ladies' garden clubs of America, with membership in the thousands. The women opposed any change in the plants available for their use, many of them from abroad. Perhaps as a result, Congress didn't act that year, nor the year after. Impatient, Marlet instead took his zeal for change to state governments. States had the power to police anything entering their borders, and no state had more plants coming in than California, mostly owing to the Hawaiian Islands. After the island's 1898 annexation to the United States, ships shuttled between Honolulu and San Francisco, carrying sugar, pineapples, and the occasional crate of guavas. Marlett asked California officials in Sacramento if they were aware that the Mediterranean fruit fly, also known as both the West Australian fruit fly and the Bermuda peach maggot, had recently been spotted on Oahu. And did they also know that steamships from Hawaii were arriving weekly, almost entirely uninspected, in San Francisco? Technically, it was illegal for California to act on its own. Its jurisdiction extended to its borders, not over them. Only the federal government could regulate between states. And yet, Marlett's fear campaign had whipped up such frenzy on the West Coast that California's governor, Hiram Johnson, the man who would be Teddy Roosevelt's failed running mate a year later, decided to act unilaterally. Governor Johnson was a grouchy, impatient man. He had no interest in waiting for Congress to protect his state from impending attack. His administration created a quarantine division, which almost overnight began to prohibit the shipment of all fruits from Hawaii, inspected or not. When it came to travelers themselves, who were guaranteed a measure of protection against searches of their shoes, bags, and bodies, Johnson leaned on the steamship companies that operated between Hawaii and California. Faced with the threat of losing access to California ports, the companies forced passengers to sign a waiver consenting to a body search. If it meant a safer country, travelers were glad to oblige. Fairchild, however, was incensed. Marlett had drummed up overblown fear, and then, in an affront to Thomas Jefferson's framework of a federal republic, egged on a state to thumb its nose at the federal government. Fairchild took this personally. He marched to Marlett's office, where the two got into a shouting match. Both men yelled past each other, as though arguing over a wide ravine. But that wasn't the worst part. The worst part hadn't happened yet. The worst part would wait until Frank Meyer began sending plants from his second expedition in 1911, not long after California instituted its new policy. Meyer shipped material from eastern China while he continued to walk across the Caucasus, Russian Turkestan, Chinese Turkestan, and a new part of Siberia. Fairchild had mostly shielded Meyer from the public feud with Marlett, so Meyer couldn't have known what would happen when his heaping pile of cuttings, suckers, and seeds finally landed in San Francisco. Meyer's shipment contained 30 tons of Asiatic plants, meticulously packed, labeled, and organized. The contents may have yielded the key to a new industry of citrus, new apple varieties that would one day be American heirlooms, or grapes that would elevate America's wine producers decades ahead of schedule. The world would never know. Even Meyer, a man who had faced the gravest indignities on a continent that seemed to ooze with disease, crime, and death, even Meyer, who had seen all the horrors humans were capable of, froze in eye-bulging disbelief when he learned that as soon as his crates reached San Francisco, they were seized, fumigated, and burned to ashes. That summer, Fairchild took a break from the feud. He wanted to escape the tension and the scorching heat of Washington. The ill-ventilated Department of Agriculture was only habitable in early morning, so Fairchild had adopted the habit of arriving at dawn and staying inside the steamy building as long as he could bear it, dashing off correspondence by hand to save the time it would take to type. When he'd had enough of it, he suggested to Marion that they go see her parents in Nova Scotia. Mr. and Mrs. Bell always loved seeing the Fairchilds, and particularly the pair of rascals known as the Fair Children. David and Marion now had two. Their second, a daughter, had come that spring. To the great delight of Barbara Lathrop, they named her Barbara Lathrop Fairchild. When the Fairchilds landed in Canada, Mrs. Hubbard, Marion's grandmother on her mother's side, urged David and Marion to extend their trip to come visit her in England, where she summered each year. The Fairchilds didn't object to traveling even farther from Washington. The same type of transatlantic steamer that once shuttled Fairchild across the ocean on his first overseas trip now carried him, his wife, and their two young children. The voyage was unremarkable compared to the life-changing ocean crossing when Fairchild met Lathrop. Their arrival left them perfectly punctual to have tea with Mrs. Hubbard at her English estate near the border of Scotland. Fairchild and Marion wandered through the cool, damp air visiting the gardens of Mrs. Hubbard's neighbors. He marveled at the large conifers, many of which had not long before been introduced to the United States. He visited Merthley Castle, constructed in the 15th century. He was in a daze from the piercing debate in Washington, and in a sort of denial that plant introduction, to which he had devoted his life, was at risk of withering away. The fight over foreign plans didn't stop while Fairchild was abroad, but it did escalate when he returned. What had begun at the Department of Agriculture and had then risen to the halls of Congress and the California State House would now be brought to the people, a war for public opinion. Fairchild mapped out a plan. He proposed speeches to the scientific societies in Washington. He submitted an article to the Youth's Companion magazine of his childhood, hoping inspired kids could convince their parents that exploration was good and exciting. He asked his friend Edward Clark, a writer, to contribute an article for the influential Technical World magazine, a feeder of news and commentary to newspapers across the country. Fairchild provided Clark with the stacks of letters Meyer had written from Asia, each of which had come with a new shipment of seeds and cuttings. Fairchild couldn't believe that anyone who learned of Meyer, a man cheating death for farmers he didn't even know, could oppose the type of plant introduction that, for over a decade, had enriched America. "Explorer Meyer," Clark would write, "has frozen and melted alternately as the altitudes have changed. He has encountered wild beasts and men nearly as wild. He has been the subject of the always alert suspicions of government officials and of strange peoples jealous of intrusions into their land. But he has found what he was sent for." In the package of materials Fairchild sent Clark, he included articles that demonstrated the popular appeal of Meyer's work, including one from the Los Angeles Times in 1908, detailing how Meyer, with just coolies and carts, set off to cow a region of outlaws, brigands, and murderers. Fairchild urged Clark to underscore the success of plant introduction, many exciting foods made possible by Fairchild's hands and virtually all under his watch. The thick alfalfas from the Andes that had radically extended the range of American alfalfa, the dates from the Middle East that had yielded just that year 5 tons of fruit in Southern California and Arizona, the mango industry in Florida that had grown from nothing to a commercial behemoth. The list continued with the same pace as one imagines Fairchild banging his head against a wall. Seedless persimmons, new cherries, 10 forms of olives, apples, pomegranates, wild peas, hardy oranges. None of this was to diminish the danger of invading pests, but Fairchild lobbied Clark, and anyone else who would listen, in a country increasingly fearful of the outside, that there were protection measures already in place. Rooting out the threat of foreign invaders should be the work of government scientists, not of untrained port workers around the country. As Fairchild expected, Clark's essay would run in many newspapers in agricultural hotspots like Duluth, Minnesota, Sandusky, Ohio, and Corning, Iowa, where agricultural sympathy could go far. Marlett, meanwhile, had decided on a different strategy for his campaign. Why kowtow to farmers when the people making policy decisions were on the locomotive corridor between Washington and New York? The better strategy was the undemocratic one, to lobby the influential eggheads in Washington, who could then push Congress to pass a law for plant quarantines. Who cared if farmers liked it? Mostly out of strategy and a little out of spite, Marlett hit Fairchild in the most sensitive of places, his family. Marlett pitched an article about the dangers of plant invaders to the National Geographic, the same magazine that listed Fairchild and Swingle as associate editors. Gilbert Grosvenor, the chief editor, and Alexander Graham Bell, the society's erstwhile president, were partial to Fairchild, but neither could deny that Marlett had the credentials to make his argument. The magazine was a journal of science, not a family mouthpiece. In May of 1911, 1 month after Clark's essay defending Fairchild and glorifying Meyer was published around the country, Marlett's article was awarded top billing in National Geographic, the lead story, with a forceful cover line. "Pests and Parasites! Why We Need a National Law to Prevent the Importation of Insect-Infested and Diseased Plants," by Charles Lester Marlett. Marlett's report was breathless and hysterical, but it was compelling. The magazine, which now regularly published photographs, ran 31 images with Marlett's story, nearly all of them showing trees crawling with colonies of vermin. These pests had caused great damage, Bartlett said. The Argentine ant was destroying citrus in Louisiana. The alfalfa leaf weevil had already decimated hundreds of fields of alfalfa in Utah and is spreading to adjacent states. To say nothing of all the diseases still to be discovered, ones that could kill the sprawling fields of potatoes, corn, and wheat. Fully 50% of the important injurious insect pests in this country are of foreign origin. Among these are the codling moth, the Hessian fly, the asparagus beetles, the hop plant louse, the cabbage worm, the wheat plant louse, oyster shell bark louse, pea weevil, the croton bug, the anguma grain moth, the horn fly of cattle, and in comparatively recent years have been introduced such important pests as the cotton boll weevil, the San Jose scale, the gypsy and brown tail moths into New England, the Argentine ant into New Orleans, and the alfalfa leaf weevil into Utah. A properly enforced quarantine inspection law in the past would have excluded many, if not most, of the foreign insect enemies which are now levying an enormous annual tax on the products of the farms and orchards and forests of this country. Without providing evidence, Marlett claimed the annual loss due to pests could be as inconceivable as $1 billion. The number made Fairchild's small-scale boasts of industry growth, 5 tons, dozens of trees, look quaint by comparison. Marlett also laid blame for the obstinacy. This effort has been blocked very largely by a small body of people who, careless of the consequences to the country at large, feared some slight check on freedom of their operations, Marlett wrote, speaking squarely at those who imported plants, like Fairchild and his star explorer, Meyer. The story made valid points. A changing world had spread disease faster than ever in history. The golden age of travel had also been the golden age of transport, moving everything, good and bad, across oceans with unprecedented volume and speed. Moreover, Marlett's photos weren't doctored. They were taken with the intention to shock, but all were based on things that were, in fact, happening in the United States. Swarms of moth larvae or blister rust were real problems, causing towns in some places to chop down full groves of pine. Yet Marlett's argument fractured where it assigned blame. If small-scale imports of lemons, apricots, or cherries could be linked to outbreaks and field wipeouts, Marlett couldn't show it. He bore the burden of proof to rationalize a new law, and he fell short. This nuance wasn't lost on Fairchild, who was himself guilty of having an overly idealistic view of nature, believing that diseases could be stamped out easily and that the benefits of research always outweighed the risks. But Fairchild's opinion fit within the idea of globalization. Building a wall of isolation wouldn't give America an advantage. It would hamstring its efforts to remain competitive. The whole trend of the world is toward greater intercourse, more frequent exchange of commodities, less isolation, and a greater mixture of the plants and plant products over the face of the globe, he would argue. Closing America's borders would render the country a little like the cannibalistic tribes of Fiji, isolated from the world, and forced to adopt unseemly habits to sustain itself. When Fairchild saw Marlett's essay in National Geographic, the first impulse for a man not prone to impulsiveness was to resign from the board. It surprised him that Bell and Grosvenor, who ran the magazine, would give unsubstantiated hysterics such a high platform. But Marion, who was befuddled that the dispute had become so personal and so quickly, urged her husband to combat words with better words. A bit like Lathrop in earlier days, she encouraged Fairchild to continue the argument, to win at any rhetorical cost, rather than walk away pouting. Resigning would have turned Fairchild into a small scientist, she believed, easily dismissed as a man of ego over fact. So Fairchild lobbed the shuttlecock back. 5 months after Marlett's 1911 essay in National Geographic, Fairchild penned the October issue's leading story. With it, Fairchild attempted to soften the debate, to remove the drama he sensed was putting off the casual reader, and to reframe the scary topic as something almost humanitarian. New Plant Immigrants by David Fairchild. Plant exploration, he explained, had barely touched the fringe of its possibilities. 31,000 different plants had come into the country by now, and that quantity represented only a small fraction of the bounty still waiting to be discovered. Together, he said, they demonstrated the greatness of the possibilities which progress in agricultural research is creating. A point of particular pride was that, compared to Marlitt's 31 photographs showing gruesome scenes of vermin, decay, and neglect, Fairchild's photos showed delectable specimens, robust forests of bamboo, bunches of ripened dates, swollen alfalfa, a bulging persimmon. It was subtle, and perhaps no one but Fairchild noticed, but there were 33 in all. In reality, dueling magazine articles amounted to small megaphones at a time when it seemed like everyone was shouting. For in the early months of 1913, the earth shifted again for plant introduction. Woodrow Wilson became president on March 4th, and with his arrival came the end of James Wilson's 16-year stretch as Secretary of Agriculture. It was, and remains, the longest tenure for any cabinet secretary in American history. Counting the days he spent clearing his desk after Woodrow Wilson's inauguration, James Wilson held the office under four presidents. In that time, he expanded the Department of Agriculture staff and expenditures sixfold. Secretary Wilson wasn't sad to go. Rising from a poor Scottish immigrant to United States Secretary of Agriculture had been one of the world's most meteoric paths, living proof that America was committed to building itself with the best people from around the world. Once a ruthless political manipulator, Wilson in his later years had mellowed, even humbled. It genuinely surprised him that each president had decided to keep him in the job, a sign of his capability and how little McKinley, Roosevelt, and Taft had trusted their own expertise on matters of food and soil. President Wilson's victory had come largely on domestic issues. Campaign contribution limits were too high. The federal government was too poor not to levy an income tax on every person. The weakest Americans needed help. The implication had been that foreign policy could wait, or, depending on the day someone asked, it didn't matter. The imperialist policy that men like McKinley, Roosevelt, and Taft had built for decades, the one whose centerpiece was a world for America to exploit, now seemed foolish in a world full of danger and mistrust. While McKinley, Roosevelt, and Taft had spread America's reach by collecting colonies, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, and protecting others, Cuba, Panama, Wilson believed America could make do with its assets at home, not expensive and hard-to-reach ones abroad. Part of his platform called for the independence of the Philippines, less out of moral responsibility than because of a "why bother" approach to a territory that had soaked up so much American treasure for a decade and yielded little in return. And so, with his right hand raised, Wilson's oath of office ended America's 14-year stretch of imperialism. Fairchild found 1912, the year of Woodrow Wilson's election, lamentable in other ways, too. The president's inward, not outward policy about America's place in the world would also extend to agriculture. Wilson believed that the future of American farms wasn't in novel foods, but in efficiency. Farming more by farming smarter. It was a worthwhile goal for a country trying to build itself, but Fairchild was as familiar with large-scale farming as he was with Parcheesi. His expertise was in botany, not running a farm, and this ineptitude cost him, and his office, relevance. Worse, one of the last acts of Congress before Wilson's election had come at great cost to Fairchild. The long-standing feud between him and Marlitt boiled over on August 20, 1912, when one of them was declared the winner. Marlitt prevailed when Congress passed the Plant Quarantine Act, a name as blunt as the action it required, to regulate the entrance of all foreign plants into the United States. After years of advocating for America to close its doors, Marlitt had bested Fairchild. The law wasn't the Chinese wall that Marlitt once proposed that America build around itself, but the Quarantine Act halted the unrestricted flow nonetheless. Even having won, Marlitt couldn't stop fighting. When he learned that the Secretary of Agriculture would have the power to clear plants for entry, he argued that such discretion was too specific for a man of such generalized power. The bill was eventually amended to give authority to a new agency called the Federal Horticultural Board, which, conveniently, Marlitt controlled. Despite Secretary Wilson's former joust with Fairchild, the outgoing secretary would have been a robust ally of Fairchild's now widespread program of plant introduction. Wilson had benefited from Fairchild's success. It was at least one reason he kept his job so long. And Wilson had loved Frank Meyer, reading with enthusiasm the letters that came from China. The James Wilson skeptical of plant introduction in the 1890s had become a devoted apostle of adventure and horticultural modernity. Secretary Wilson's departure meant a less sympathetic new secretary would take the job, one who shared President Wilson's view that America didn't need foreign things. If there was a bright spot among the disheartening prognosis, it was that Frank Meyer kept exploring. Even though Meyer had to subject his findings to more and more inspection and scrutiny, there remained at least one narrow avenue still open for importing plant material. The new Secretary of Agriculture, David Houston, a university president with no farm experience, asked Fairchild to turn Meyer into something of a double agent, exploring to find useful plants that would have to pass inspection, and to investigate plant diseases infecting the United States whose antidote could be found abroad. The mandate allowed Meyer to depart on a third expedition, a proposed journey through northwestern China, through Gansu province to the border of Tibet. Houston asked Meyer to investigate whether the blight poisoning America's chestnut trees was of Chinese origin, and if so, how the Chinese people, with their centuries' worth of farming experience, had stopped it. To find out, Meyer sailed first to Beijing. He found the fungus, and, to everyone's surprise but his, that the Chinese had long before bred trees resistant to the fungus. Meyer took cuttings of the trees. When his shipment was received, a group of pathologists told Fairchild that Meyer's work was the most meaningful accomplishment in a decade of pathology research. This pleased Fairchild, who had grown accustomed to Meyer working miracles. It also showed, in one example, how plant exploration offered not only problems, but solutions. Fairchild was satisfied seeing Meyer's eventual shipments home, all inspected carefully. He sent new varieties of walnuts, hazelnuts, and chestnuts, the new seeds of jujubes, pears, apples, peaches, and a small red berry-like fruit known as haw. His shipment set a new record for quantity of plant material ever shipped from China to Washington. All of it passed quarantine. When Meyer was in the field, this type of abundance was normal, but it had a side effect that Fairchild couldn't have expected. The dispatches that the Los Angeles Times had been publishing about Meyer's adventures, the ones that detailed his harrowing tales of near-death encounters and Hollywood-style evils, had attracted the attention of a young man in Altadena, California, who had grown up gardening and then run a commercial nursery. Wilson Popno, 21 years old and easily excited, wrote to Fairchild that he had a particular fascination with avocados and wanted to explore like the gun-toting, road-hardened, danger-seeking Meyer. Popno said in his letter that he had already been around the world once, hunting for dates for his father, who ran a commercial nursery. But now Popno wanted to be a real plant hunter, a government agent. The job would bring an upgrade in budget, adventure, and if he could emulate Meyer, glory. Fairchild wrote back to Popno and explained that plant exploration was detailed and tedious work, newly subject to rules and obstacles, and even during the best day exploring still required substantial expertise and immeasurable danger. Popno assured him he had what it took. He explained that he had wandered the same streets of Baghdad Fairchild had once risked his life to reach. He had caught malaria in a foreign port and had been holed up with dysentery for weeks. Wilson Popno, at just 21, knew what seed hunting entailed. And after he gave it some thought, Fairchild, now 44, agreed. Finding skilled young men to continue the burdensome job of plant exploration had now become his life's work. Chapter 18. Fly the Coop. Under the new rules of the Quarantine Act, introducing plants wasn't illegal, just much harder. Any plant that entered the United States had to be brought directly to Washington, D.C. No detours like the cross-country trips that Meyer was making with cargo from the West Coast. Fairchild was ordered to build a receiving center on the National Mall and was given $5,000 for it, a sum large enough for only a modest shack, one fire away from wiping out the entire program. Entomologists would pick up the new samples every week, put them in a queue for testing, test them, and if they passed, return them to Fairchild scientists, who would propagate them into seeds and send them out to farmers. Introducing plants was still possible, but the new obstacles effectively covered what was once an open highway with red lights and stop signs. Fairchild couldn't restrain Meyer even if he wanted to. Meyer continued to explore, but with increasingly erratic emotions. He was everywhere, all at once, and accelerated both his collecting of plants and his intensity for the world. He showed up in places nobody suspected. He visited his family in Holland, and then St. Petersburg, and in the months that followed, ventured to Chinese Turkestan and remote Mongolia. His letters to Fairchild showed the miraculous way Meyer cheated death, sometimes daily, as he was continuously robbed, threatened, and warned not to enter areas rich in useful crops that he visited anyway. He covered icy terrain and emerged atop mountains only to keep walking down the other side. He truly hated staying still. On this, his second expedition, he clipped cuttings of wild apricots and asparagus that he would send back to Washington. Both found their way into the hands of nurserymen, and eventually, farmers. This had become the usual process for Meyer's findings. He mailed back the newest and most durable varieties of plums and cherries that grew abundantly in high temperatures. He picked up soybeans, which he now had studied in volumes so great he could spot tiny nuances in their appearance and how they grew. Constantly afraid of being poisoned in a culture where he stood out, he ate only bread and sausage and drank only tea, the only vitamins he consumed coming from the fruits and vegetables he chewed for study. Very few things could have stopped Meyer. He was reckless and ruthless and had seen such horrors that warnings of mountain gangs or animal attacks were as good as fiction to him until they actually happened. But Meyer had heard reliable reports about fighting in the Chinese territory. There was a rebellion afoot in 1912 that had started a year earlier to overthrow the Qin Empire, China's last imperial dynasty. Despite the setbacks and institutional roadblocks, the threat of revolution, and the new rules that covered his work in Washington, his luck never ran out. "It seems as if the good wishes from so many people who take an interest in my work keep some sort of protective atmosphere around me," he wrote to Fairchild in the months before he came back. Indeed, Meyer returned to Europe before crossing the Atlantic. Again, he averted tragedy with the blind luck that had become his signature. In April 1912, Meyer held a ticket to return to America on a majestic new ocean liner, the RMS Titanic, the most impressive and durable ship ever built. If he hadn't become ill the day before the voyage and traded his ticket for one on the next ship, the RMS Mauritania, departing 4 days later, he, a grown man unqualified for a lifeboat, would have perished in the cold Atlantic. Meyer lasted just a few months in Washington before he itched to return to Asia. Something about the continent and its endless plants called to him, and with such ferocity he quickly forgot about the fighting that had only months before driven him away. His short stay in Washington, however, meant he could meet Wilson Popenoe, the young man who looked at Meyer with such fawning admiration it left Meyer speechless. He was used to people eyeing him suspiciously and threatening to break his neck, not admirers staring glassy-eyed with a goofy smile. Meyer didn't want to mentor anyone. He had too much work to do. "I wish I had 7 bodies, he would later tell Fairchild, complaining that he didn't have enough time to complete the work he found so urgent. Indeed, if Meyer had had 6 assistants, he could have used them. Because what Meyer lacked most wasn't money or energy, it was time. China's unrest was only a small matter compared to the larger war the world was poised to fight. America hadn't yet entered the conflict that would be known as the Great War, the first war to drag together all of the globe's major powers, but it was heading in that direction, and the prospect of a changing world effectively put Meyer on a deadline. Before returning to Asia, he decided to make a tour of the United States. It wasn't for tourism, but for research. He wanted to go to Gansu Province, an area believed to be insulated from much of the fighting. It also stood to reason that, being so scarcely visited, it was full of plants that no Westerner had seen. If this was true, it would be impossible for Meyer to bring them all back. He needed to understand which kinds of things farmers wanted, and what kinds of growing conditions they could provide. He visited farms along the northern United States, traveling from Boston nearly to Seattle, popping in on men in their fields. Often they emerged from their barns curious why a sloppy, bearded man was chewing on their plants. Meanwhile, back in Washington, having been rebuffed by Meyer, Popenoe became the protege of David Fairchild instead. Fairchild was his boss, and also his landlord. Popenoe rented a room in the Fairchild's home in Maryland, and paid for it with the generous $8,000-a-year salary that Fairchild granted him. Such a large sum likely reflected Fairchild's former budget, designed to sustain a dozen plant explorers. The new quarantine rules and bad publicity had made the work so arduous and prone to inducing hysteria that many of the former contractors had quit. By 1915, Fairchild's best hopes had almost entirely narrowed to Meyer and Popenoe alone. Popenoe was eager to return to traveling after the trip to Baghdad he'd described in his pitch letter to Fairchild. He had a singular focus to board a boat, to go somewhere unknown. He wore the same pair of torn pants day after day, and only barely combed his hair. He was, in almost every way, like David Fairchild had once been, full of passion but empty in direction, a man who wanted to go somewhere but oblivious to how to get moving. The only difference was that Popenoe lacked self-doubt, the crippling overanalysis that kept Fairchild away from Java long after Lathrop had given him the means to get there. Popenoe was ready to leave at a moment's notice, provided someone first told him where to go. This imbalance of knowledge and experience fashioned Fairchild a little like Lathrop, the mentor wise in the world who had seen and experienced all that the young man before him dreamed of. Fairchild seemed to relish the opportunity to pay forward what Lathrop had once given him, a leg up in a world where not having one would have spelled a dramatically different fate. "The chief tried always to help me as Uncle Barber had helped him," Popenoe would later tell people. Fairchild egged Popenoe on. He chastised him. He urged him to get his hair cut. Just as Lathrop had done at the beginning of their travel together, Fairchild, only half-joking, made Popenoe promise that as long as he was doing the work of plant introduction, he wouldn't get married. "Keep away from the girls," Fairchild told the junior explorer. "Wait a while, and you can have anything you want. If you settle down now, it'll greatly interfere with your career." Even so, Fairchild remained worried that Popenoe would become restless and, as the boss put it, fly the coop. Lathrop, meanwhile, continued to reappear on occasional visits to the office or in letters from around the world. Without Fairchild, Lathrop was aimless, wandering tropical ports, drawn to warm locales where his arthritis wouldn't flare up. When bored, he would talk up nursery growers in the tropics and ask questions Fairchild had given him, or convince them to send stock to Washington, attention David Fairchild. In exchange for Lathrop's efforts, Fairchild granted him the title Special Agent for the Department of Agriculture, with the annual salary of $1, although Lathrop would never cash the checks. When it came time for Popenoe's first assignment, Fairchild thought of a task with relatively low risk and high potential. He wanted Popenoe to investigate the popular naval orange and scour Brazil, where it was rumored to have originated, for a better variety to boost farmers in a flooded citrus market. Fairchild deemed the mission worthwhile because the naval had been one of the few plant introductions to have occurred by accident. By a series of such lucky coincidences, it almost defied belief. In 1869, William Saunders, the American government's chief horticulturist, asked American consuls to contribute valuable seeds from their countries. One consul, in Brazil, sent twigs from a sweet, seedless orange that grew near the port of Salvador, but the cutting died en route. He then sent a shipment of buds from Brazil, which Saunders propagated onto rootstock and then sent to Florida, where they, too, died. By a stroke of incredible luck, Saunders had also given two trees to his former neighbor in Washington, a woman who had moved to California. She planted the trees in her doorway, Lore would relay, and then watered them by hand. Her husband was too cheap for formal irrigation. In 1879, she entered into a state horticultural contest a seedless orange with an odd indentation in its bottom, a navel, someone would call it. It won first prize and carried the humble orange from obscurity to ubiquity. Fairchild was skeptical that it happened so conveniently. Having made plant introductions for decades, he knew the road was paved with pitfalls and failure. He knew what kind of expertise, growing conditions, and gardening finesse were required to recreate the precise fruit someone saw in a faraway country. A dominant orange grown by accident seemed as far-fetched as man one day walking on the moon. But if the navel was, in fact, a stroke of luck from a charmed consular official, Fairchild imagined that even better fruit could be found by a professional trained to know what to look for. Fairchild paired Popenoe, the adventurer, with two citrus experts for a three-man expedition to Brazil. In the weeks before they left, Fairchild was impressed to see Popenoe studying Portuguese, preparing himself with the skills and knowledge to do a thorough job. Pope No and the pair of citrusmen departed New York on October 4, 1913, aboard the SS Van Dyke, which, to their surprise, was also carrying Theodore Roosevelt. The former president, out of office and bored with his post-presidency, had decided to embark on a punishing and dangerous adventure. Pope No, ever the opportunist, stood next to Roosevelt as reporters on deck yelled questions and flashed bursts of light. Roosevelt and his son Kermit would leave the boat at the Amazon to explore the River of Doubt. Pope No wrote in his trip report that, while standing next to Roosevelt, he put on a dignified look and tried to appear like he was meant to be there all along. In the spring of 1914, Fairchild had never been busier. The Quarantine Act constrained the work of plant introduction. The new law made it impossible for private nurseries to import their own plant material. His office had become a bottleneck, in many ways drained by the imperative that all American plant activity was subject to his office's oversight. When he wasn't in the greenhouse supervising the receiving and unpacking of material, his office overflowed with visitors, many unannounced. A man who had once enjoyed the meditative silence of weeks-long sea voyages and wandering alone from field to field, he hated the constant activity. Carrying on profound research in the hubbub that prevails in most government offices is as difficult and rare as composing good poetry on a noisy street corner, he wrote. Fairchild was putting in the same long hours he had as a young bachelor when he had no one waiting at home. But now he had three children. His third, Nancy Bell Fairchild, was born in 1912. He sometimes slept in his office to avoid the long commute to Maryland and back. For this, his mother-in-law, Mrs. Bell, complained he was neglecting the kids. She had a way of using generosity to cloak her nagging. If money was the problem, she offered innocently, she could help. Money wasn't the issue. The issue was that Fairchild could feel the pyramid that had taken his entire life to build slipping like sand through his fingers, rejected by an oblivious nation that didn't understand what effect its ignorance was having on its agricultural growth. He stayed in his office long into the night devising ideas. As he saw it, the way the law was implemented was costing enormous sums of money that might otherwise have gone toward research on plant diseases, or, better yet, means of disinfecting contaminated crops. Fairchild became angry every time he thought about how the law would deter young people like he had been, who might choose a career in botany or horticulture if the road were smoother. Moreover, Fairchild could see the ways that the Quarantine Act was beginning to hamstring farmers. They didn't need novel crops quite like they did in the 1890s, but now, a generation later, they needed better versions of their existing crops. I felt strongly that when the quarantine discouraged private initiative, the government was obligated to develop its own methods of introduction and dissemination for their benefit, he wrote. By this he meant breeding seeds together, hybridizing, creating new forms of fruits and vegetables in labs. This was supposed to be private sector work, the type of research that gives one farm a leg up over its competitors. As the United States marched toward war, there would be more ill-conceived efforts by the government, rather than private companies, to solve societal problems. Many of the directives would land on the desk of Fairchild, now, by default, one of the country's most senior food experts. People asked him how to grow more food on a fixed amount of land, how to conserve food that already existed, and how to create drugs and oil in case of disruptions to foreign supplies. The biotechnology America developed over the next century could have easily solved these problems, particularly how to grow more corn per acre, ship bread longer distances, and create canned fruit that would last months on the shelf. There would be large agribusiness companies to research these questions, first motivated by the threat of war, and later by the promise of profit. The Monsantos, Syngentas, DuPonts. On the eve of World War, however, America, largely unprepared for a global conflict, didn't have time to experiment or to hope that men like Meyer or Pope No could solve sweeping problems on their faraway expeditions. One early idea found its way to Fairchild's desk and seemed so simple, so obvious, that he was surprised he hadn't thought of it first. If fruits and vegetables could be dehydrated, they could be stockpiled with no risk of spoiling. They would be lighter to transport and edible for years. Soaking them in water would allow them to be brought back overnight, as if nothing had happened to them. Would people even notice? Advances in this field had come from George Washington Carver, a black man who had been born into slavery in Missouri but rose to become a respected botanist and inventor. Carver visited Fairchild's office one afternoon in January 1918 to discuss vegetable drying. Carver was a pioneer in the same way as Fairchild. Both men empowered farmers to diversify. Fairchild's strategy had been through exploration. Carver's was via research. Carver wanted to find other uses for common foods like peanuts and sweet potatoes in hopes they would expand the market and help farmers sell more. He demonstrated how potatoes could be turned into flour and thus a substitute for wheat. At the USDA, he baked a loaf of bread using potatoes. The method required dehydrating the potato before grinding it into fine dust. The next day, Carver returned to the department to talk details with Fairchild, specifically about starting a pilot project to dehydrate 10,000 bushels of potatoes. At the end of the meeting, Fairchild was so impressed he slammed his closed fist on the desk. "We must do something now! We have fooled around long enough," he declared. The logic was sound, but the culinary implementation was not. Fairchild should have known by now that people wouldn't eat something new just because someone suggested it. Food introduction required cajoling and persuading, and a generous helping of luck. Despite Carver's grand plan, and even though Fairchild built a kiln at home to personally experiment to find the optimal temperature and duration to dehydrate foods, and even though he and Marion enjoyed seeing which type of dried and rejuvenated vegetables would pass muster with the kids, few people found the idea appetizing, and even fewer ate the vegetables. Least of all, the soldiers who might have benefited from the culinary convenience as they prepared to fight in Europe. The War Department shielded them from the unsavory indignity. One day, Fairchild schemed with an old friend, Emil Clemens Horst, to convince military leaders that dried vegetables weren't as bad as they sounded. Horst brought 26 types of vegetables, including dried corn, potatoes, beets, carrots, spinach, and more, enough for 40 people to sample, from California to Washington. Stripped of their water, the dried vegetables were light enough for him to carry on the train. At the Willard Hotel, where Fairchild had a decade earlier first courted his wife, he and Horst watched from the side of the room as an assembled crowd of army men, chemists, dietitians, and Red Cross officials politely chewed the samples with pursed lips and squinting eyes. "Most of the guests politely lied about it," Fairchild remarked later, "but some of them disappeared without saying anything." That included one senior official for the United States Food Administration, who would give her official report of dried vegetables to the agency's chief, Herbert Hoover. After the luncheon, the woman returned to her apartment and vomited them all out. Chapter 19. Sad and mad and so utterly unnecessary. The day Popno and his citrus men returned from Brazil was not a happy occasion. Fairchild tried to mask this fact with a barbecue at his house in Maryland to honor their homecoming, and he described their return as thrilling, but still, anyone could easily tell that after months of walking, Popno ended the Brazilian expedition with little more than a shrug. He had collected several odds and ends, including Brazilian cherries, cashew wine, guava jelly, translucent apricot-like fruit, and Brazilian grapes known as jabuticaba. Even though the men packed their cuttings meticulously and took great pains to ensure they were clean, only a fraction passed inspection. The naval orange that monopolized California soil apparently had no equal, and there was nothing better to be found. In a country where the introduction of new plants was becoming harder and harder, confirming the superiority of an existing one was reason enough to celebrate. While Popno had been gone, his small office at the department had been turned into a quarantine station for the entomology department, another step in the slow creep to extinguish plant hunting entirely. Fairchild schemed for several months to arrange a new assignment for Popno, perhaps one on his own where he could emulate Meyer. But few options remained in a world becoming skeptical of outsiders, and with America wary of the unknown. 2 months after Popno's return, events that unfolded across the ocean trivialized the hand-wringing in Fairchild's office, and it happened faster than anyone could have foreseen. In Sarajevo on June 28, 1914, a Serbian dissident pointed a gun at a man in a car who was in line to be the head of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, a man named Franz Ferdinand. Such an event normally wouldn't have made international news, except that the bullet was fatal, and another bullet killed the man's wife, who was riding next to him. The incident led to riots, and then crackdowns in the streets, and then a diplomatic crisis that devolved so quickly that militaries around the world either rushed to declare neutrality or readied for battle. The event that sparked the Great War, later known as World War I, was only a surprise to anyone who hadn't noticed the rising tides of nationalism, xenophobia, and cultural insecurity brought on by a more connected world. Within 5 weeks, German troops began crossing the border into Belgium for the first battle in what would amount to the biggest and deadliest global conflict in human history. The United States wouldn't enter this war until 1917. The country lacked a strong military, in numbers and passion. Americans were divided, almost equally, about whether to get involved in Europe. The most consequential opinion belonged to Woodrow Wilson, who explained that war would distract the country from all the progressive advances it had made, breaking apart monopolies, leveling a modest income tax to strengthen the government, creating a government bank called the Federal Reserve to manage the country's money. Wilson vowed, "Every reform we have won will be lost if we go into this war." War wasn't glamorous either. Older Americans still reliving Civil War deaths didn't want another round of loss, nor were young parents moved by the promise of valor. This was demonstrated by one of 1915's most popular songs, "I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier. Who dares to put a musket on his shoulder to shoot some other mother's darling boy?" Popno was one of those darling boys. He didn't want to fight. His hunting career was only just beginning. Fairchild put him to work collecting avocados in Guatemala, a part of the world that, at least for the moment, remained safe. Popno spent 3 years there, riding thousands of miles on horseback, living on beans, avocados, and chayotes. He wandered from field to field, and when he found avocado varieties he liked, he would take notes and return again and again to taste them in minute detail. After studying thousands of trees, he returned with 23 varieties, the best ones, to introduce to America. He sent them in tin tubes with oiled paper, having inspected each meticulously to ensure they'd clear quarantine. Considering the circumstances, Fairchild was pleased with the work. So was Popno's father, Fred, who gloated that between his selling and his son's hunting, avocados had become the Popno family business. And yet, only one opinion truly mattered to Popno, and it came in a letter to Fairchild in early 1917. Wilson Popno had captured the field, Meyer wrote from China. He conceded that the young man who once fawned over him now shared the same stage. "It will be a race between him and me to see who will leave to posterity the greater number of introductions." It was a race an aging Fairchild was proud to see his explorers compete in, so long as Meyer could stay hunting, or, at the very least, remain alive. Frank Meyer had started as a happy man, eager to have a job that let him walk and explore. But after 3 expeditions, he was becoming despondent. Each successive trip had resulted in more drama and fewer plants, cresting with his 3rd expedition, on which he shoved an interpreter down a flight of stairs after the man suggested Meyer was crazy for continuing to walk into rebel-held territory. He was drawn into a fistfight with Chinese officers who suspected he was smuggling opium in his trunk of seeds and plants, a charge Meyer's response didn't disprove. One guard roughed him up, then spit in his face. On the other side of the world, Charles Marlett was escalating his assault on Meyer's work. Marlett watched as one of Meyer's shipments on its way from China to Washington was hit by a hurricane and destroyed in Galveston, Texas. That shipment had been in Texas because of the quarantine. If not for Marlett's laws, the seeds could have gone straight away to experiment stations. Meyer was shocked and riled. To Marlett, it was a righteous stroke of luck. The only thing Frank Meyer really enjoyed was walking across landscapes and hunting plants, and in 1915, that was becoming more arduous every day. If the Washington fights and the conflict in Asia weren't enough, Meyer felt the weight of loneliness after so many years hiking alone through mountains and barren fields. He admitted to a case of Heimweh, the German word for homesickness. He once promised himself and Fairchild that at 40 he'd retire and slow down, but he had already ceased being 39. "The specter of a lonely old age looms up larger and larger, and the spectacular office of an agricultural explorer does not hold it down any longer," he wrote. "At 18 one thinks that one could see everything. At 40 you know that the world is too big and life is too short. You reduce your plans and wishes." Fairchild's response to Meyer's despondence was that it might be good for him to keep exploring, or at least to spend some time with a fellow Westerner. His entire identity was defined by plant exploration, the hunt, the chase, the conquest. People had read his name in newspapers, and his work had inspired a younger generation. Perhaps what he needed most was to keep moving